From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, we have a visit with international relations analyst Mark Sloboda, based in Moscow. We spoke with him from Moscow via Skype on Monday. Well, Mark, it's been a very eventful week or so. You have one headline with that airplane that has Iran, the U.S., Ukraine all mixed together, and Iraq. This is all by itself is, you know, kind of like a worst of the worst. That's only a sideshow to the main event, which was the execution of Soleimani by the U.S. in Iraq, which is another question. And this is today being taken up here, just for reference to domestic political purposes, as some kind of unique criminal act by the president that just might warrant, you guessed it, impeachment. So let's talk. We'll start anywhere you want, I guess, between the U.S. and Iran, or in Libya, by the way, which suddenly may be closing in on a settlement 9 years after Obama started blowing that country up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, let's be clear that the Democrats are not going to impeach Trump over assassinating Qasem Soleimani, because some public criticisms about it aside, it's perfectly obvious that the Democrats, by and large, actually support it, and that they have repeatedly continued via the authorization of military force, extension of Patriot, right, et cetera, right, continued to give Trump unilateral executive war powers,
right,
despite, of course, claims that he's Putin's puppet, or, you know, right, so on and so on. Why?
More and better tools, yeah.
Because U.S. hegemony, the global pursuit of U.S. hegemony requires quick, decisive, executive-directed military and covert action to which Congress approves, by and large, but does not want to be held politically accountable for,
right,
by the public. They right. don't want a public debate over these things. They
That's
want
right.
them to happen, and impotently throw their arms up sometimes, but go with the flow, or, you know, full-throatedly support at others. So, this has been bipartisan for decades now. And,
That's
and
true.
You know, the muted Democratic response to Soleimani, despite the election season coming up, shows exactly that.
You know, the threat, quote-unquote, if you want to call it that, to Trump over this has to do not with the outcome, which they, of course, cannot, even if it were hugely popular to criticize this policy, you know, among the population. It's not something, this is one of the heresies that you may not speak. This Trump speaking this kind of heresy is exactly why they've been after him in the first place, you know, against the neocon political international agenda. But the procedural method that they didn't consult with Congress is one, and now they're saying the reason that he did it, they're imputing the intent to him being that the only reason he killed Soleimani isn't because he's on board with the policy, which they intimate we are, but rather he did it to appease some Republican senators going into the trial in the Senate over impeachment, that the only reason he did this was so that he would keep a couple of Republican senators on the ranch to vote for him, and therefore it was a criminal act, not the thing itself. That's where they're going with this, just for chuckles, so that you have that in the back of your head.
Yeah, I don't know if that was ever a situation, considering the vote in the House.
I hear you.
I think domestic politics has. I mean, I know there's accusations that there's implications of the impeachment and the upcoming elections, but it's not so easy to see how that plays out either way. I think Trump you know, despite his rhetoric, even on the campaign about improving relations with Russia and ending regime change wars, the one exception to that was always Iran. Him and all the people, Flynn all around him, everyone, even in the beginning, was extremely anti-Iran. You know, that has just carried through to today. So I'm not so sure that the domestic political, I mean, there's always more than one reason for everything, but I'm not so sure that the domestic political calculus was so big on this. You know, and one of the things that's emerged in the past week, all right, and we have to remember that the U.S. just didn't assassinate, Soleimani. Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Quds Force, and considered by many the number two political figure in Iran.
Right.
A recent University of Maryland poll actually showed that 8 out of 10 Iranians had a positive opinion of Soleimani, and that he was the most popular political figure in the country, hands down.
Because you have the other way, you have like 4 out of 6 or 6 out of 4, depending on the day, the most popular figure is either Rouhani or Ahmadinejad. And now suddenly you have this new entry there who's more popular than both of them.
Both of them. And we know that he was instrumental in not only, of course, military and covert means as the head of the Quds Force, but he was largely in charge of foreign policy for Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, that whole area there. He was essentially in charge of that. In
fact,
we know even further that he was on a diplomatic mission.
Right, that's right.
At the time he was assassinated, all this nonsense about blowing up U.S. bases. They have evidence. Of course, they won't show it. And even the Secretary of Defense has quietly admitted that he has seen no such evidence of any imminent attack, which would be required to justify the assassination under self-defense, man, which is a nonsense reading of self-defense according to the UN Charter anyway. There are very stringent requirements about that, you know, obviously. Not that anyone really pays any attention to them.
There's
one thing you'll never hear, even the Democrats who are critical of Trump, over Soleimani, you know, say Bernie Sanders or Tulsi Gabbard, even them, you'll never hear the words international law come out of their mouth.
Right.
You'll never hear them say that this was an extrajudicial, extraterritorial assassination.
Right.
Not just of Qasem Soleimani, but also of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis.
In his own country.
Right? This was... now, he's often referred to as an Iranian militia leader or an Iranian supported or backed militia leader.
Right.
Now, what the reality is, he was an Iraqi general.
Right. That's right. That's right.
He was a member. He was the deputy commander of the Popular Mobilization Units, which is an umbrella group of many different militias that were formed when ISIS was rampant across the country. And when they were formed, there was some organization and support for them, because they're largely Shiite groupings, from Iran, with the permission of the Iraqi government.
Right.
And they were immensely successful. This is after the U.S.-trained Iraqi army turned tails and fled.
Or joined.
Right? Or joined, right? And if it had not been for them, Baghdad would have likely fallen. And even further, even President Obama was forced to grudgingly admit that the Popular Mobilization Units were instrumental to defeating ISIS in Iraq and Syria. In fact, at one point during the whole thing, and you know, not just one moment, but over an extended period of time, the popular mobilization units were the force on the ground recovering Iraqi cities, the principal force, and they were being provided close air support by the United States Air Force.
Right.
So, and Soleimani was seen as, you know, in charge of them.
He was
certainly
a general.
Had a directing role.
Right.
But since then, the popular mobilization units have long since been brought formally into the Iraqi armed forces. They are an official part of the Iraqi military. Their officers all have official officer rank. And as a whole, they report directly to the Iraqi prime minister. That is who the popular mobilization units report to. So, and they were instrumental in defeating ISIS. Now, not only was Soleimani instrumental in defeating ISIS, but previously, if you take a look at his history, he first came to prominence during the Iran-Iraq War when he rose rapidly through the ranks. He actually comes from a very humble peasant farmer background. He advanced quickly through the ranks, showing competence and intelligence in the Iran-Iraq War and so on in the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps. But he, as he assumed the top position, he was also instrumental in aiding the U.S. in their attacks on the Taliban in Afghanistan. Because again, what a lot of people don't understand, of course, is the Shiite-Sunni divide, particularly the Shiite-Wahhabi divide, long on. Iran has long been enemies with the Taliban. And Iran had long been allies with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, which were the holdouts for a couple decades since the collapse of the Soviet-supported socialist government there at the hands of the originally U.S. and Pakistani and Saudi-backed Mujahideen, which would become the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Iran, you know, where everyone else forgot about Afghanistan, Iran was still aiding the Northern Alliance in its holdout territory in the far north. And when the U.S. went into Afghanistan,
that was their ally.
After 2001, they went in with Iranian help, and not just Iranian help. Qasem Soleimani personally was the one who helped arrange this.
Wow.
And some reporting done in the New York Times said that at the time, whereas, you know, this relationship between Iran helping the U.S., helping them on the ground, helping them with diplomatic relations as they supported the Northern Alliance and turned that into what would become the Afghani government again today. He was really pushing the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, that maybe we should. He was sticking himself on a political limb here, saying, "Well, you know, we can work with the. We're working with the Americans." We maybe we should reassess our whole thinking of them and let the past, the coup, the SAW, the CIA, let the past be the past and realize that we have common grounds today. He was pushing that political line in the Iranian government.
Oops.
And that was just before George Bush then invaded Iraq and declared Iran part of the Axis of Evil. Which signaled that they were next on the chopping block.
Yeah, no
so
kidding.
A whole potential rewriting of a diplomatic rewriting of U.S.-Iranian relations with Soleimani playing a key role in the reconciliation from joint activities on the battlefield against the Taliban, which was completely shut down then. And of course, Soleimani has been instrumental in the fight against, ISIS, al-Qaeda, and, you know, all the other 31 flavors of jihad in Syria. He was the one who in 2015, personally, according to many reports, both in the Iranian press and in the Russian press, he was the one, he flew personally to Moscow, and supposedly he personally impressed and convinced Putin to start the Russian intervention to save the Syrian government.
Wow.
So, and further than that, Russians love him, at least the Russian government loves him, because he personally led the mission. The mission on the ground of a wide range of forces that included some Iranian special forces, popular mobilization units, Syrian military, some Russian forces, some Hezbollah, that all went together and rescued a Russian pilot that had been downed by Turkey early in the conflict. He personally led that mission.
No kidding. So, wow.
Yeah. You can find the reports on it, and you can Google it if you check up Soleimani and Russian pilot.
No wonder they don't like that guy.
Yeah, so I mean, the guy is I mean, you know, he is regarded. I mean, he's regarded in Iran as you know, respectfully pious man. You know, in the Islamic Republic, but he's more known for his secularism and as for his nationalism. He is a champion of Iran and the Iranian state, and has long been that way. He's not a religious fanatic. He's a pragmatic man,
right,
and has made lots of compromises and backdoor dealings, good and bad, and so on. You know, he's not a saint. I mean,
but
neither is any JSOC commander or a Russian Spetsnaz, you know, general, you know, so on. Is he drenched in blood, you know, as the Western press? Sure.
Well, he's in the swimming same way in a river of it. There's an ocean of it around him. Of course he's going to be,
I mean, look at the environment he operates there in the Middle East. And yes, he has been steadfastly opposed to U.S. interests in the Middle East, in that, you know, particularly that, you know, the U.S. depends for its tripod of hegemony over the Middle East on Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Right.
And you know, of course, Iran has, you know, very adversarial relations with Saudi Arabia because of the Shia-Sunni divide, and Israel, you know, over the, you know, the occupation of Palestine,
right,
which Soleimani is famous for having created a strong interoperating network. You know, they had all existed previously, but creating a strong interoperating network of Iranian allies throughout the region, which largely consist, of course, of Shia, but not entirely forces. All right. First of all, you know, there's the strong presence in Iraq after the U.S.'s disastrous overthrow of Saddam Hussein, with the Shia majority there, largely having sympathy with Iran and with Soleimani, and where he's regarded as a hero with the popular mobilization units as you know, the hand he had in the beginning in their formation and training. But also in Syria, of course, where he's been more active than anyone as, you know, the visible figure leading fighting on the ground. And he's one of these types of leaders who always leads from the front, right? He never sends his people to do things, which is really kind of amazing that he's actually been alive as long as he has, considering some of what he's been up to.
Right.
But Hezbollah and their defense of Lebanon from Israeli incursions there, and even in Hamas, which of course is Sunni, he's seen as providing support for them against Israel,
yeah.
Israeli occupation, ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And of course, there is, you know, the much ballyhooed support of the Houthis in Yemen,
right,
which has actually only become a real thing since the Saudi invasion, not
right
before.
Right. I mean, look, not for nothing, the material basis of any support he can offer anybody is Iran, which has been under siege practically since the revolution. You know, you have going on right on the periphery of Iran, the Syria, which it doesn't touch, but it's like 10 feet away. Iraq, which has been, you know, destroyed over a period of at least the last 30 years. And Afghanistan on the other side, Saudi Arabia got its guns pointed across the Persian Gulf. Turkey, by the way, also has had a hand in destroying Syria, for example, and is no friend of Iran's. So the whole, you know, that whole region is, you know, the sea of blood that one could get immersed in. And of course, Iran has limited resources to engage in all of this stuff, and yet has done a rather remarkable job with him helping to steer it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's this network of allies and foreign policy and international relations that he's built over the Middle East,
right,
you know, over the last two decades. That is what the U.S. is worried about in retaliation in some type of blowback from his assassination, because all of these his allies that he's built for Iran throughout the Middle East, in particular, I mean, not only did they, you know, look to support from Iran, but to him particularly. This man was seen as a hero general, not just in Iran, but in all these places, and, right, you know, dozens more smaller militias and factions across the Middle East, you know, that, you know, don't necessarily all merit mentioning. These are just the big players. But now they all want revenge against the United States,
right,
and anyone seen as aiding them in this, which of course is Israel and Saudi Arabia and the UK and possibly others. And
right,
Iran doesn't necessarily actually control them. Not completely. I mean, they,
right,
have influence, that's of course. But it's like, you know, do we hold the U.S. accountable for every South American death squad that they've armed and trained,
right,
or provided arms to, or to every bunch of head-chopping, suicide-bombing jihadis in Syria or Libya or, you know, or the Mujahideen in Afghanistan? No, of course not. We don't, right? That's
correct.
Not the way it works. And they – they're, you know, you could refer to them as Iranian proxies, but of course they all have their own agency and their own leadership. They were allies, right? Iran provided them support. There's no question about that. But again, Soleimani was instrumental as the front man, as the one actually doing not just the military organization, but the diplomacy. They all want revenge for him. Nasrallah, Hezbollah is,
right,
you know, speaking actually the loudest at this point. And actually the Iranian government, Rouhani, is like trying to calm them down. And the same thing with the popular mobilization units in Iraq. And this is the real danger here. The big danger to the United States is not necessarily blowback from the Iranian state, but from all these network of Iranian allies, particularly in the Shiite world, that Soleimani has built over the decades. The U.S. didn't just declare war on Soleimani by assassinating him, and they didn't just declare war on Iran for assassinating one of their generals and someone who was largely seen as the next president, as a possible next president for Iran. By the way, he was that, you know, big,
right,
apolitical figure already, and not just a top general in Iraq, right, who was instrumental there in the defeat of ISIS, Mohandas, and the popular mobilization units. But what the U.S. actually did is declare war on the Shiite world.
Yeah.
And that's a big one.
Yeah.
And the real danger is that Iran doesn't actually control, not, you know, like, again, influence and support is not control. And they all of these want revenge in their own way for what they see as the man, you know, who, you know, was the front man of their alliance in the resistance, with the capital R network against the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia in the Middle East. So, you know, they've really,
as a matter of fact, here's the irony, Mark. The one person that had, if not the power to marshal across all those divisions, you know, some sort of action to say, don't do it, was him. He's the only one that had influence in all those quarters enough to tell people, okay, just bide your time until the next action or whatever to stop crazies or rogues from going crazy or rogue.
Now, what's the one thing Soleimani was working towards and wanted more than anything else was the U.S. out of the Middle East.
Yep.
And what is the immediate political blowback in Iraq with a nominally Democratic government with a newly empowered Shia majority that, to a large extent, identifies with Iran, or at least doesn't see them as enemies. Of course, Iraq, Iran are the top trading partners. Soleimani was seen as the one who helped originally help organize and train up the popular mobilization units, which rightly are seen as saving Iraq from ISIS. You know, saving Baghdad, and then you had this Iraqi general, and it actually just wasn't one airstrike. There was a string of airstrikes over the week, not yet just against Soleimani and Mohandas, but against a lot of leaders of the popular mobilization units. These are Iraqi military formations, and the U.S., which was a guest, supposedly, in their country, using their bases in the fight against ISIS, was assassinating some of the top Iraqi people on the ground who were instrumental in the defeat and the continuing fight against a, you know, any possible resurgence of ISIS, because they politically identified in a positive way with Iran.
Yeah.
That's why they were killed.
You know, and they affirmatively punished them.
There was over 40 of them, 40 Iraqis assassinated by the U.S. in the last week. And result of this is the Iraqi parliament has voted to the U.S. Well, what they actually voted was a non-binding resolution to tell the prime minister to get them – they kind of passed the buck to the prime minister in this – to get the – to get the, you know, to pass the buck to the prime minister to tell the U.S. to get out of our country. You're not welcome anymore.
Yep.
You've abused our sovereignty. You've killed our own people. You've killed more than 40 Iraqis who were uniformed members of our military.
Right, you killed some of us that made deals with you for you to be here in the first place.
First place, yeah. And we were, again, instrumental in the fight against ISIS. If we take a look at who is celebrating Soleimani's death, who is celebrating it? ISIS.
Well, yeah.
Al-Qaeda,
yeah,
right? And their friends in Idlib and so on. Turkey is celebrating it, right? Because Soleimani was instrumental in defeating Turkish-backed proxies in the field, right?
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia and Israel and the neocons and their, you know, so on, the humanitarian interventionists, whatever, in the United States. That's what's happy about it.
Well,
and they're,
so, you know,
they're just as happy about the assassination of these Iraqi leaders. And Iraq parliament, this is the thing. The Iraq parliament is, of course, dominated by Shiites, because the Shiites are the majority in Iraq now. Right. And it's they have now a democratic system.
That's the result of the U.S. invasion and occupation. Yeah.
The Sunnis and the Kurds did not participate in that vote. They tried to sabotage it by not being there, hoping there wouldn't be
boycott,
a quorum.
Right.
But there just was, and they passed it. So these are the potential consequences of the assassination of Soleimani. One, Iraq says you have to get out of our country, the parliament, the Shiite, you know, dominated because Shiite majority parliament says you killed our people, you killed our friend in Iran who was seen as a hero by us for helping us defeat ISIS. You're not welcome here anymore. Get out. And the U.S. says no. The Sunnis and the Kurds, they don't have any great love for the Shiites. They didn't have any love for Soleimani. They didn't have any love for the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit Commander Mohandas. They did not participate in the vote. This, first of all, the U.S. is told to get out of Iraq. They say, politically, no, we're not.
And they also say, we're gonna steal all your money if you try to make us, by the way.
So that's the threats. But if the U.S. is out of Iraq, they're also out of Syria.
Yeah.
Because their occupation of the cereal and oil fields in East Syria depends on supply lines
and
reinforcement out of Iraq. So that would mean out of Iraq and Syria.
Right.
That is Soleimani's dream. That is Soleimani winning.
Right. Master stroke. That's so ironic. All right. We got to stop right here. But that is a perfect, perfect touch to this. All right, Mark. Thanks. We'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks for having me, Don. Always an honor and a pleasure to be with you on CPR.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.